As I mentioned during our announcement time, we're beginning a 12-week, I'm going to call it an adventure of faith. We're going to be taking a journey that's going to be guided and narrated for us by the author of Mark's Gospel. Now, Mark is the first human being to write down a written account of the early church's understanding of Jesus, the collection of stories about him, his teachings. It's amazing to think that for 30 or more years, the church had no written record of Jesus. All was being passed on year after year, decade after decade, simply by what was called the oral tradition. People knew the stories well enough to be able to keep those stories alive. But as the apostles began to die, the church realized that there needed to be sort of an authoritative account of the gospel. Because what was happening was that some other kinds of stories about Jesus that weren't historically based began to sort of catch fire. There's a story in one of the other Gospels the church has not included in the Scriptures, for example, of Jesus being a little boy and having a playmate who was teasing him. And Jesus, like all five-year-olds, got annoyed and he pronounced a curse and his playmate died. He went home, Mary grabbed him by the hand, brought him back, and made Jesus raise his playmate from the dead. So these kinds of stories began to develop about sort of this imaginary person. So the apostles realized we need to have some account that's been blessed by the eyewitnesses that helps us to keep clear what the historical gospel of Jesus was about. So Mark began the first person ever to write this down. But Mark wrote this gospel not to give us sort of an objective reporter's view of Jesus. He himself was a person of faith. So he has an agenda. He wants to help other people come to faith as well in Jesus. So he begins his gospel with a very strong proclamation. We might call it a disclaimer. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So Mark puts it right out there. This is who Jesus is. This is what I believe to be true about him. And now I'm going to spend about 16 chapters, it's the shortest of all Gospels, telling you about this Jesus, about this Christ, about this Son of God. Only 16 chapters long. It's 8 chapters shorter than Luke, 4 chapters shorter, or 5 chapters shorter than John, and a whopping 12 chapters shorter than Matthew. Only 34 pages long in my Bible. So I would say the most important 34 pages ever written down by a human being. And so we're called to journey together through this adventure of faith. You can join us at home. Again, Mark is 16 chapters, so if we do 12 weeks, about a chapter or so, maybe a couple of chapters every so often to allow us to keep pace as we move through the Gospel of Mark. This morning we're going to be focusing on a passage near the end of the first chapter. Again, Mark moves quickly. Jesus is always in action. You'll find the words often immediately and then quickly. And Jesus is always moving. He's a man of action. And so Mark starts not with any birth narrative. He starts right with Jesus as an adult going into ministry. John baptizes him. He goes out in the desert. He's tempted. He comes back. He calls the disciples. He starts healing people. All in the span of 34 verses, this happens. And so by the time we arrive at this point in the gospel, Mark tells us the whole town gathered at the door where Jesus was. He's already got a name for himself. His popularity is booming. Crowds are forming. He's been healing folks, driving out demons. And now Mark tells us what Jesus does next. Listen now for God's word to you. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him. And when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." He replied, "Let us go somewhere else, to nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I have come." So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. Recently, I read an interview with a woman who had just turned 100 years old recently. And they asked her what it was that she most enjoyed about being 100, and she said, you know, no more peer pressure. You know, that's one way to deal with peer pressure, just to outlive all your peers. But for most of us, that's probably not going to be the best solution to dealing with this human reality called peer pressure. Jesus, we believe, historians believe, is about 30 years old when he began his ministry. If you follow the events of the Gospels, he lived somewhere from 1 to 3 years after that. So he died either at 31 or somewhere around 33 years of age. So he was not a man who was ever going to outlive his peers. But he knew what peer pressure was about. And so here we are, the 35th verse of the first chapter, and Christ encounters his first overt expression of peer pressure. Again, he's been out there doing his thing in the area of Galilee. He's been preaching. He's been healing folks, casting out demons. And then he goes off by himself early some morning to pray. And Simon wakes up and realizes that Jesus is not here. But who is here are crowds of people who are showing up. They've heard about Jesus. They themselves perhaps want to be healed. There's a new star in town. And so Simon, thinking he is doing Christ a favor, gets up and he goes looking for Jesus, and he finds him, and he gives him this bit of news. Everyone is looking for you. Now my guess is that Simon says that in a tone that is more like, everyone is looking for you. What are you doing out here? We've caught lightning in a bottle. The crowds are growing. Your name is spreading. This is the time to open a Facebook page. This is the time to send out some tweets. This is the time, come on, to post some things on Instagram. You are a celebrity. What are you doing out here? He's acting like Jesus' agent, you know. I got to bring you back to where the people are. You know, they've gone out of their way to come see you. And there are some people in real need. A little boy back there, you know, who's got a high fever. There's an old woman. Can't walk. What are you doing out here? The crowd expects things from you. Learning what the crowd wants. Something we all begin to learn at a pretty early age. When we're young children, of course, the crowd that matters most to us is our parents. We begin to understand that our parents have certain expectations for us. We learn pretty quickly that there are certain things that we do that make mom and dad happy and smile and maybe give us treats and pick us up. And there are other things that we do that mom and dad are happy about. We see the frown, the displeasure. Later on, we might be put in time out. There are things we learn as kids, that there are things that people expect of us who have a lot of power over us. And as young kids who want to survive in the world, we realize that it's pretty important to give mom and dad what they want. And then we go off to school and realize now there are other folks we have to play to listen to. Teachers. Classmates. We realize that when we behave in certain ways, people tend to affirm us. They want to be around us. We become part of the group. But if we behave in ways that don't please teachers, parents, or peers. Life goes in a different direction. It's harder. It's more lonely. It doesn't go as well. And all that, of course, is part of the normal process of being socialized. I mean, we have to learn that there are people in this world besides ourselves that we have to learn how to get along with. And we learn that people do have certain expectations, yearnings, desires for how we are to be, how we are to behave. And again, all this is normal stuff. The danger, though, is that as we are taking in all this information, realizing this is what I need to do to please mom and dad, this is what my teacher wants, this is what my peers want from us, this is what other people want from me, we begin to lose sight of who we truly are. We begin to live life, if we're not careful, primarily from a perspective of what do I need to do, who do I need to be able to meet all the requirements and expectations and yearnings of those around me. How do I act in a way that allows me to be accepted and loved, and even if it costs me something of who I truly am? In his book, Finding Meaning in the Second Half of Life, which I know I've cited many times, the author, James Hollis, lays out one of the central challenges of becoming fully human. The challenge is, he says, is the recovery of personal authority. What does that mean, he writes, naive and dependent as we all began? We were obliged to try to meet our needs, indeed in some cases even to survive, by adapting to the conditions imposed by our environments. The family of origin, socioeconomic conditions, cultural imperatives, and the like. Each adaptation required the sacrifice of instinctual truths, personal needs, and the desires of the soul. That's such a key sentence. Each adaptation required the sacrifice of instinctual truths, personal needs, and the desires of the soul. The daily repetition of necessary adaptations leads to the progressive positing of authority outside ourselves. We begin to look to people outside of us to tell us how we need to be as human beings. Yet over time, the external authorities shift, are internalized. Mom and dad begin to live in here. They may be gone physically, but they live on in the own inner voices that we have, as well as the inner voices of our culture and our friends. And they begin to govern from within. They become now the controlling board, the board of directors telling us how we need to live our lives. Even the most overtly powerful among us are subject to these inner tyrants. The challenge we face is to find what is true for oneself and to live it in the world. The challenge is to find your own voice, your own truth, your own absolutely unique identity in the cacophony of sounds that seek to govern us from around us and within us. That is, I believe, the heart of the spiritual journey. If we don't get to that point, we really are living merely as puppets, as projections of other people's desires for us. We never really live from our own sense of our true identity. And we see Jesus trying to navigate that challenge right here. He knew also what that was like. And it's not just the pressure from the crowd in Galilee he's dealing with. It's not just that the disciples want him to do this. What he's really carrying at this point is the whole multi-century expectation of what the Messiah is supposed to be like. I mean, imagine God's people carrying for 8 centuries an expectation of what the Son of God will be about. In their mind, he's going to come into town and he's going to start doing miraculous things, and pretty soon he's going to start casting out the Romans. He's going to destroy God's enemies. He's going to usher in an unparalleled time of prosperity and peace for God's people. Here it comes. We've been waiting for it. And he knows that this is what the people are expecting. They're wanting, even demanding. And over, as we'll see through Mark's gospel, he gets pressured. Be that person. Come on, start a revolution. In the desert, we're told he's tempted. Try on all these possibilities for your life and see which one fits best. Be the miracle worker. Spend your life feeding the poor. Be spectacular. Give the people what they want. But he wrestles and he says, no, no, no. And so after the disciples come looking for him, after he spent this time in prayer with God, he says to them, let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I have come. The crowds couldn't tell him why he was here. The disciples couldn't give him that truth. Centuries of expectation by the Jews couldn't tell Christ, this is why you're here. He only knew why he was here. He only knew his purpose because he knew that God himself could give him that purpose. And he began to understand that why he was here would run in stark opposition to why everybody else wanted him to be there. He had to fight for his own direction, his own way, and to resist all the pressures to conform to what others wanted him to be. It must have been immense pressure. I mean, he was aware of the people in that crowd waiting for him who needed to be healed. And he was a compassionate man. But he also knew, I didn't come here just to heal people. If that was my purpose, I'd go back, and that's what I do all day. It's an important thing. It's a great work, but that's not why I have come. And all of us, you see, face that kind of hard work if we want to be more than about honoring all those voices that try to claim us to be a certain way. If we want to live the life that God desires for us, the life that is uniquely ours to live, requires the listening to and the honoring of our souls. And doing that requires courage. Requires being willing to disappoint people. To step outside of those roles that perhaps we've spent decades perfecting. To step into some deeper truth, some riskier step, that others might around us say, you're crazy to do that, but inside we know that somehow that is the direction that we're meant to go. As I look back over my life, I see times when my soul spoke to me. And growing up in my household, money was always an issue. So much tension around money. My mom especially thought we never had enough. We were always on the verge of being destitute, even though objectively I don't think we were close to that. But for her, it was always an issue. And at some point, as a teenager, I decided, you know, what I really want to do is I don't want to have any money issues. And I don't think it was just for my own desire. I think part of what I was trying to do was to live in a way that somehow would fulfill the hopes and dreams of my mom. Carl Jung once said something profoundly insightful. He says, you know, what usually has the strongest psychic effect on the child is the life which the parents have not lived. It's the unfulfilled dreams of parents that often the kids pick up and say, I will achieve that for you. So we become the doctor that our parents wish they could have been but never were able to. Or we take on some role that we think will carry on desires of those who brought us into the world. And I thought, well, what I can do is make lots of money. And so I thought I'd be an attorney, because back then attorneys were billing people for $150 an hour, and I worked for an attorney. I thought, I'll make lots of money. And then I got into law school. I worked my tail off to get into law school. And again, I got the letter of acceptance saying, you've made it. Top 10 law school. And I read the acceptance letter, and my soul wept. Or at least it wasn't clapping. It was like I was reading a recipe out of a cookbook. I thought, I should be excited. But I wasn't. And I realized at that point I had chosen that direction not because of my soul's voice, but because of other voices. Took a U-turn, didn't go to law school, went to seminary, became a pastor. Conclusion of being a pastor, I also had a moment my soul spoke to me. I realized I was not happy being a pastor. I had become, in my own understanding, a religious professional. Somebody who knew how to do church things. I learned how to preach and to teach and to visit people. But my soul, again, was not engaged. I said to God, I can't be a pastor like this. I do not want to spend my time merely perpetuating institution. I need to know this life you speak about, this gospel that Christ offered. I need to know this living water in my own soul, or I can't be somebody who helps others to find it. I got to know it myself. So I began this sort of inward journey to understand how it is that God encounters us in our own depths. And I realized that what my soul was saying was not to teach people about God, but to help people to know God. We can know an awful lot about God through our theology and our Bible readings, but we don't really know God personally. It's all kind of a waste of time. And I said, God, I need to know you. And my soul said, you know, Brian, if you're about helping 10 people to really know God, it's more satisfying than preaching to 10,000 people who don't. So I've tried to pay attention, you know, to what is it that brings life, that brings a sense of fulfillment. And now I'm at a place in my life where I feel like I need to hear from God again. How do we know you in a world like this? In a world that's so overly active, filled with fear. Lord, how do we know you in the church when other things are more important? When commitments to schedules for soccer and hockey crowd out any attempts for people to grow themselves spiritually? How do we do this? I don't know. But that's what I need to be about. And so I'll be heading out this afternoon for 3 or 4 days just to pray and reflect and say, God, how can we know you more deeply? How can I know you more deeply? Now, your journey, I know, is different than mine. We all have a unique path to travel, but there is a common challenge. There's a common set of expectations that we have to achieve if our lives are to become something truly satisfying. Living out our God-given identities is never easy. Even those closest to us may not understand. But at some point, the soul begins to send out signals. We might feel it as depression. Something amiss. Being lost in our own lives. And the culture might say, it's okay, just go shopping, just watch this TV, just post something else on Facebook, just stay distracted, or find an addiction, or just get over it. Because we don't really know what to tell you. But God does. And that's why Jesus goes back to prayer over and over again. He knows that somehow that's the only place he's going to really connect again with why he was here. If he had gone back that day with the disciples to Galilee and committed himself to a ministry of healing, people back then would have been blessed. Lives would have been changed. But we wouldn't know him. We wouldn't have a Christian faith. We wouldn't have a hope beyond this life, because if he had done that and gone away from his purpose as the Messiah to die and be raised for all of us, we'd all be most pitied. Thank God he paid attention to why God sent him here, not what the people were expecting of him. He knew his mission was to live out a life as the suffering servant for all humankind. Now that role has been fulfilled. Thank God none of us, despite periodic temptations, are the Messiah. We can let that go. Somebody's done that for us. But there are other roles, expectations, identities that God yearns to bless the world with, and they are hidden within each one of us. And if you pay attention to those thoughts that might be dangerous that you push aside, if you wake up with a dream that's grabbed hold of your attention, if there is a returning yearning to step in a new direction, maybe your soul is saying to you, this is what God has in plan for you. Again, I promise to you it won't be easy. I can promise you that others may not be excited about it, but I can also tell you that through the example of Christ, it is the way that we give to this world the priceless gift of being who we truly are. God didn't send us here to conform to everybody else's expectations. He sent us here to release to the world the gift of who we are through him. And may we as his people walk that road, find the courage and the trust to live in this way, to allow us to be truly who God yearns for each one of us to be by his mercy and by his grace. All praise and honor and glory are his today and forevermore.